This podcast has 365 days left to save the Earth. Japanese cartoons, eh? Well, I've watched one of them once. So, today we're going to be talking about Star Blazers. The thing about Star Blazers is that whenever you bring it up pretty much anywhere, you encounter one of the really old-timers of the fandom. Well, not super old, there are still the guys who watched Astro Boy when it was first airing. But eventually, and this is 100% true in my experience, eventually one of them will come up and say, "Hey, I remember Star Blazers. I watched that show when I was a kid. I skipped school to watch that show when I was a kid." Well, I can't condone that specific behavior, I guess. But it does tell you the kind of hold that this particular localized show had on people who watched it back when it first aired in the 70s and still remember it that way today. Now, the story of Star Blazers really begins, like everything I'm going to be covering, on the other side of the Pacific, starting with a guy by the name of Yoshinobu Nishizaki. Now, Nishizaki had been a producer for a while, at least. However, he never really had what we would call a real breakout success. In fact, his most recent show at that time was an animated adaptation of Osamu Tezuka's Triton of the Sea, which wasn't received that well. So he decided to actually break away from adaptations and decide to do his own thing, and he worked with his people and created the seed for a space adventure series that would eventually be called Asteroid Ship Icarus. And the plot of this show was that our heroes, on board a ship built from a hollowed-out asteroid, are leaving Earth because it has been devastated by an alien attack and will completely die out in 1 year. However, on a distant planet called Iskandar, there are the means to save the Earth from inevitable extinction. Now, the general thing about this show that he was expecting to do is that the asteroid ship would become a kind of a pressure cooker, because it would be about a bunch of people trapped in a hostile wilderness, the most hostile wilderness because it's space, and this would eventually get to them because they were removed from civilization in a dangerous situation all the time, and eventually some Lord of the Flies-style shenanigans might break out. However, Nishizaki knew that he couldn't pull off this kind of story himself, so he turned to ask someone else to help supervise the construction of this project, and turned to a guy who was a moderately successful manga author at the time by the name of Leiji Matsumoto. Now, Nishizaki had a very high regard for Matsumoto's storytelling. He said something along the lines of, "Matsumoto is the kind of man who can mix oil and water." So he asked Matsumoto to come aboard, and told him, "Hey, I'm doing this space adventure project, and I'd like you to supervise parts of it." And Matsumoto's reply was, "Actually, I'd like to supervise all of it." Now, whatever Nishizaki may have thought about that response, Matsumoto did eventually come aboard, and he was given all the power that he had asked for, and this is when the show really started to take the shape we would recognize. Because one of the things that Matsumoto had decided to change is that it would no longer be an asteroid ship. The ship that would be making the journey to Iskandar would actually be the resurrected World War II battleship Yamato, thus changing the name of the show from Asteroid Ship Icarus to Space Battleship Yamato. And Matsumoto didn't actually pull this idea out of nowhere, because the image of a flying battleship Yamato had already been rather firmly established in Japanese adventure fiction at that point. You can find plenty of magazine covers from the 60s depicting a flying battleship Yamato. Another thing that Matsumoto ejected was the whole Lord of the Flies ideas. Now, we would eventually get a Space Lord of the Flies with Infinite Rivius, but that's a topic for another time. So, the show was recast into a heroic space adventure, and they went forward with Matsumoto's ideas, and they eventually drew up a pitch for a 52-episode series. The idea was that the audience would follow the adventures of the space battleship Yamato in real time. The year-long journey would be updated once for every week of the year. So eventually, the TV executives agreed to the pitch. However, they would only do it if it was cut down to a 39-episode series. So they cut it down to a 39-episode outline and started production of the series, during which they were informed that they were cutting it back further to 26 episodes, which explains some of the odd pacing that shows up in the early parts of the show. It's paced for a 39-episode series for the first 10 episodes, but after that they have to make quite a few cuts. Matsumoto had really intended to include a lot of other things. He planned to introduce the space pirate Captain Harlock in that space battleship Yamato, with Harlock being a fixture of some of Matsumoto's later works. So the series was released, and it got somewhat middling reception until they released a compilation movie of the first series of Space Battleship Yamato. And then that's when it blew up. And it blew up so big that people on the other side of the Pacific started to take notice. The Westchester Corporation identified Space Battleship Yamato as a potential children's property for the United States. And so the first thing they did was make an English localization of the Space Battleship Yamato compilation movie and renamed it Space Cruiser and released it on the West Coast. And after that, they ended up gaining the rights to the first two seasons of Space Battleship Yamato. Space Battleship Yamato, and the creatively named Space Battleship Yamato 2. And these would be rebranded into Star Blazers, The Quest for Iskandar, and Star Blazers, The Comet Empire. Now, in the transition, there were certain edits that were going to have to be made, largely because there were things that really American children weren't allowed to know about, generally. However, what's also interesting are the things they didn't do, and one of the big things that they didn't do with Star Blazers is that they didn't muck around with the episode order like they did with a lot of previous localized shows, because previous localized shows tended to be more episodic, like Astro Boy and Eighth Man and Gigantor and Speed Racer, whereas Space Battleship Yamato had a very tight, very structured story arc. You can't mess around with the story order at all. As for what they did change, they had to, of course, remove all the fan service and all of the reference to booze because the kids can't know about the devil drink. And they also had to make certain political edits. The thing is, the politics of Space Battleship Yamato kind of resembles some of the politics of Japanese right-wing nationalism, especially of the 70s, because there are certain sequences that just couldn't really be shown in America. Like, there's a segment where the captain of the space battleship relates the old history of the Yamato to the crew and how it was sunk during the Second World War, and during the sequence where they show it sinking, they use the same music for the bad guys that they with they use the same music for the American attack planes that are sinking the Yamato that they would use for the Gamelon invaders throughout the rest of the show. And when you take a look at the premise, it's basically about a resurrected World War II Japanese battleship. Not just anyone, but the pride of the Imperial Japanese Navy Japanese battleship, going out into space to fight a distant and merciless empire that's bombarding the hero's homeland with radioactive weapons. So he might start to think, there might be something going on here. So they remove the sequence showing the history of the Yamato, and they rename the resurrected Yamato to the Argo. But again, what's also notable is that some of the edits that they eventually would make actually made the series stronger and more accessible. For example, there's a sequence in the beginning during a hopeless space battle against the Gamelons when the main character's brother refuses to retreat along with the captain of the fleet. And in Space Battleship Yamato, it's because I cannot stand the shame of retreating from an enemy in battle. So he turns around, charges the Gamelons, and dies. But in the Star Blazers, the same character decides, it's a game of numbers, there are only 17 men on my starship and 490 on your flagship, I'll make sure that you make it back to Earth alive. And then he turns around to hold off the Gamelons and still dies. It's the same animation, but the context makes it better. And there's another sequence where one of the main character is down in the dumps, and Captain Avatar invites him up for some of the old booze hall. But in Star Blazers, it was edited that Avatar was offering him some spring water from a spring that used to be near his house, which is even more powerful because the surface of the Earth at the beginning of the show is a giant dust ball. The first time you see Earth in this series, it looks like Mars. And again, what's important is what they didn't edit, because one of the things that's pushed hard and not really glossed over in the Star Blazers is that people die in war, and it's a pretty horrible thing, which is stronger than some of the cartoons Americans might get down the line. So the show started airing first in San Francisco area and then spread to the rest of the country from there. And it was a pretty big success because this was really the first localization where it felt like people started to really care. The voice acting was of a slightly higher caliber, and one of the things about the voice acting is that voice actors weren't really credited in those days. So it's actually been a decades-long project finding out who exactly did the voice acting for Star Blazers, and there are a lot of names we still just don't really know. But anyway, it was actually a somewhat unusual but still well-loved show for the time, even in comparison to other shows that had been localized. And there are a couple of things for that, to explain why. First off is that it was a show with a real story arc, and second, it offered a very compelling exhortation for viewers to return next time because of the countdown. Because at the end of every episode was a cliffhanger, basically. Every episode ended with something like, the Star Force has evaded the evil Gamelon trap. However, their quest for Iskandar is not yet over. They only have 278 days to save the Earth. And, you know, that kind of thing is just gonna bring people back. So now I'm going to take a look at the actual substance of the series. Basically, the premise of Quest for Iskandar is that Earth has been locked in a basically hopeless war against a alien empire based on the distant and mysterious planet Gamelon, and Earth has no hope of defeating their star fleets, and the Gamelons have actually started bombarding Earth with radioactive asteroids, so that the surface of the Earth is unlivable and man is forced to live underground. What makes this even worse is that even this is starting to fail. It's failing to protect them because the radiation poisoning is seeping deeper, and within 1 year, mankind will become extinct and Earth will be unlivable for any of its natives. However, during a last hopeless battle to try to repel the Gamelons from Pluto, a messenger starship from the distant planet Iskandar arrives with gifts. First are the plans for a powerful new starship engine, the Wave Motion Engine. And second is a message from the planet Iskandar that she is willing to help them reverse the damage done by the attacks by the Gamelons if they make the journey to Iskandar. She will give them something that will restore the Earth back to the way it was. It was called the Cosmo Cleaner in Space Battleship Yamato, Cosmo DNA in Star Blazers. So, led by the experienced Captain Avatar, the crew of the Argo must now set forth and make the 148,000 light-year journey to Iskandar and back in 1 year, or humanity is extinct. And the show doesn't really gloss over any of this. Oh yeah, Captain Avatar? Yeah, they changed some of the names to more Star Wars-y names. This was 1979, everyone wanted a piece of that pie. And besides, no one in America had heard of the Shinsengumi. So, the real strengths of the first season are kind of... They have to deal with the fact that the show's production did not exactly proceed as planned, because 10 episodes are spent just getting out of the solar system. And as compelling as the struggles of the crew of the Argo may be, there is a real sense that sometimes you just need to get on with it. However, one of the bigger strengths of the show is the opposition. Even though the Gamelons do not really retain their kind of warrior fanaticism that they had in the original space battleship Yamato, the thing they did retain was their leader. Leader Deslok, probably the most entertaining cartoon villain of the 70s, and maybe even beyond. Because Leader Deslok was a dominating space tyrant, but one of the changes they made to his character for Quest for Iskandar when they moved him over to Star Blazers is that he was a bit less generic, arrogant space dictator, and what they kind of removed from his character, they replaced with 100% pure, unadulterated sass. Like, there's one sequence in the middle of the series where he basically executes one of his ministers for more or less being drunk at a meeting. And in the Star Blazers, they changed it because, once again, kids aren't allowed to know about the devil rum. They changed it so that he still dumps the guy down a pit, but the reason he gives for doing it is, I can't stand people who laugh at their own jokes. And I'm like, well, I wouldn't kill anyone over it. I'm gonna let that one slide. So yeah, Leader Deslok really became his own character compared to Leader Dessler from the original space battleship Yamato, but is equally as entertaining, and that's a really hard thing to do. And one of the things that really reinforces exactly what kind of power the Star Force has to deal with is the fact that outside of the escape from the solar system, the Star Force really stops to stand and fight the Gamelons. Pretty much every single time after that, they're escaping from the Gamelons, or trying to evade some sort of Gamelon trap. There isn't really a battle between the Star Force and the Gamelons until fairly late in the series. You know, after they've left the solar system. And there are a bunch of harrowing escapes. And the show touches on other interesting things in its kid-friendly, family, daytime show sort of way, such as coping with extreme loss, or, you know, what makes a person in the case of IQ-9, the shipboard robot. And one of the worst things they have to deal with, the fact, is that partway through the series, Captain Avatar, the experienced, steady hand at the wheel, the unflappably courageous veteran space captain, he starts dying. Because he takes a wound in the very first space battle of the series, and it turns out to actually be mortal. So the Captain Avatar actually slowly becomes more and more incapacitated, so the younger main characters of the show actually have to take up the responsibilities of running and completing the mission to Iskandar and back. So it's a really varied sort of show. It's not really the kind of cartoon in the 70s that most people would have been familiar with having, not even other anime series, because this was really about serious stuff. Of course, since I've mentioned that there are other seasons, you pretty much know how this is going to go. They do make it to Iskandar, they do manage to defeat Leader Deslok, and they manage to return back and save the Earth, and another thing they did not edit out is that Captain Avatar dies once the mission is complete, once they've made it back to Earth to save it from extinction. And that left a pretty big impression on a lot of people who watched the show. Which means that taking the step of picking up the second season was a good idea, Space Battleship Yamato 2, because that series may have been even better because it was written and paced for 26 episodes. It wasn't cut down, it wasn't based on a larger plan. What it was meant to do, what Space Battleship Yamato 2 was meant to do, however, was to decanonize the ending of a movie called Arrivederci Yamato, which was the original telling of the fight against the Comet Empire, only to save the Earth, pretty much all of the heroes of Season 1 died. And Leiji Matsumoto was actually very regretful about this ending, because in an interview later he said something like, the ending for Arrivederci Yamato, the message that I saw in the telling later was asking young people to sacrifice their lives for the pride and behest of dead elders, and that's not really a message I was comfortable with. So he decided, along with Nishizaki, of course, to create a second full season of the series Space Battleship Yamato 2, which came over here as the Comet Empire. So Earth has been restored. However, it has attracted the attention of a basically large clan of nomadic warrior conquerors called the Comet Empire. So-called because the massive space fortress that serves as their capital is protected by an energy shield that looks like a white comet. And these are extragalactic invaders. They come from the Andromeda Galaxy because this is a Matsumoto series. Nothing good comes from the Andromeda Galaxy. And they're setting their sights on Earth because the Earth people are resourceful and resilient. They manage to bounce back from near extinction. And Prince Zordar, leader of the Comet Empire, would love to have those kinds of people as his subjects, because they could teach his other, presumably more timid subjects, a thing or two about being awesome. So he's already sent some of his fleets ahead, and Leader Deslok has also hitched his wagon to the Comet Empire, because he was driven off of Gamalus. Well, Gamelon in the English version, anyway, at the end of Quest for Iskandar. And he's really good friends with Zordar. And yeah, Deslok managed to somehow miraculously escape death at the end of the first season. Meanwhile, Derek Wildstar, the real main character of the series, has basically taken on the temporary captaincy of the Yamato. But then the crew starts getting messages from another mysterious spacewoman, Trelania of Terrasart, to come because she has dire news about a threat from beyond the galaxy. So the old crew of the Argo steals the Argo and escapes the advanced battleships of Earth. They built new ships in the intervening 3 years, like the supposedly more powerful Andromeda, and they are eventually let go to investigate this call for help. Now, they do have to deal with the responsibilities of fighting this new powerful enemy without the aid of the experienced and unflappable Captain Avatar. But this series is also where Leader Deslok really starts to come into his own, because deposed Leader Deslok is actually a somewhat more interesting character than Space Tyrant Leader Deslok, because he's the kind of character you don't really see that much of in any kind of adventure fiction. That is to say, a deposed evil overlord who now has to beg for help from pretty much anyone else who passes by. So he made friends with Prince Zordar, and he has actually a good plan. I will gather all of my loyalist fleets, we will combine forces with the Comet Empire, these guys seem to be really strong and know what they're about, and together we will conquer Earth, I will destroy the Star Force, we will have my revenge, everything will be fine. The problem is that pretty much everyone else in the Comet Empire, except Prince Zordar, is very suspicious of Leader Deslok. So they're constantly ignoring him, and undermining him, and mocking him, and not listening to him about how powerful the Argo and the Star Force are. And the only comfort that Leader Deslok really has in all of this is the fact that he gets to gloat whenever they inevitably fail because they didn't listen to whatever he had to say. Like, there's a scene very early on in Comet Empire where Leader Deslok is talking to the assembled commanders of the Comet Empire and saying, look, the Star Force is very strong, they can pull off all kinds of tricks, you really should be careful around them. And one of them is like, well, maybe you just sucked. So, Admiral Nazca actually fights the Argo and the Star Force at the planet Brumis, and loses all of his ships except his command carrier, gets completely wiped out there, and so, while he's retreating, he gives a call to Leader Deslok, and is like, Leader Deslok, I am so sorry! I never should have doubted you! The Star Force are incredible fighters! I don't even know what I'm going to tell Prince Zordar, I've lost everything! And so Leader Deslok responds, well, he deserves to know, why don't you just tell him the truth? After all, you tried your best, loser. Yeah, Leader Deslok gets to be both Statler and Waldorf. And so, this kind of thing happens all the time. Like, he argues with General Torbeck, and this is actually a scene that's improved in the English dub, because they are assigned to guard planet Terrasart against the Star Force's visit, but General Torbeck decides, you know what, I'm gonna go out there and fight him. And in the Japanese version, Leader Deslok is like, hey, what are you doing? Why don't you stay here and actually work together with me like we planned? And Torbeck is like, yes, I understand our plan, but there's no glory in sitting around here. And in the English version, the actual argument is somewhat more nuanced, because in the English version, it actually went something like this. General Torbeck, where are you going? We're supposed to defend this planet together from the Star Force. And he's like, well, there's the real danger that if they get here, Trelania will be able to transmit them some information that could pose a very grave risk to the Comet Empire, so I can't wait around here and hope that doesn't happen. And Deslok goes, well, then it's all the more important that we work together to crush the Star Force, as in the original plan. I believe you're a good soldier, General Torbeck, but a good soldier follows orders. And Torbeck is actually a fairly formidable opponent. The crew of the Argo have to use pretty much every last trick they have in order to beat him, and they fight him for like 3 episodes. So, and when Leader Deslok finally does take the field, it's pretty obvious that he has actually learned from the first series. He doesn't try to take them head-on unless he has some kind of big plan to neutralize the Argo's fighting capability. Which means that while the Comet Empire tries to batter the Argo down with whole fleets, Leader Deslok is a lot more careful with his forces and is able to provide threats using single ships backed up by other plans. However, this eventually fails because he keeps on getting undermined by other people within the Comet Empire. So the Star Force is eventually able to make it to Terrasart, where Trelania informs them of the full scope of the threat of the Comet Empire, and the Argo phones back Earth and tells them what's going on and to gather every possible ship they have. Now, the big problem with Trelania of Terrasart is that she is the focal character of this entire journey. She's a very major character in the Comet Empire segment of Star Blazers, and her English voice acting is terrible. I'm sure that the woman who did her voice is fine at what she does normally, but it feels like in this particular series, she was told to imitate the Japanese voice actress of Trelania of Terrasart when it was something that was outside of her range. It just doesn't really work, which is very, very unfortunate. It's, by the way, around this time that certain people within the Comet Empire try to brand leader Deslok a traitor. And Deslok basically is like, you know what, I'm just gonna do my own thing. And I believe he tells Prince Zordar, you know, before leaving, you know, I tried to be your friend, but certain people are making that impossible. Where Prince Zordar always really, he really wanted Leader Deslok to be his friend. It's almost sad that they have to part like this. Because I guess when you're the kind of violent space emperor that Prince Zordar is, you tend not to meet that many people like you. And in that case, Leader Deslok really was a kindred spirit on the space lanes. So what really ends up happening after this is that the main fleet of the Comet Empire and the Earth Defense Force beat each other to death at the Battle of the Cassini Gap near Saturn. However, they aren't able to stop the Comet Empire's massive space fortress, and so Earth is really forced to surrender, and the Argo becomes the last resistance against the Comet Empire. However, Leader Deslok isn't about to let this go that easy, so Leader Deslok, with his brand new flagship that he has in this series, they end up in the fight with a Star Force. The Argo actually boards Deslok's flagship. Derek Wildstar gets wounded, and another main character, the female lead Nova, comes to save him. And this sparks a very rare crisis of conscience in Leader Deslok, because he realizes that his thirst for revenge has made him a worse person. He's basically been siding with thugs against the brave and sacrificing and courageous humans. You know, basically working with people he would have never given the time of day while he was still ruler of Gamelon. So after all of this, he's like, you know what, my heart isn't really in fighting you people anymore, because people like us who both dearly love our home planets shouldn't really fight like this, because it doesn't allow us to be our better selves. Oh, and by the way, the weak spot of the Comet Empire space fortress is the underside. See ya! And so Leader Deslok pieces out of the series. So in the end, they manage to destroy the Comet Empire's space fortress, and Prince Zordar escapes in his command flagship and leaves behind all of the people who undermined his friendship with Leader Deslok to their death. However, even with all of this, Prince Zordar is too powerful to defeat, so the Argo is actually crippled in the ensuing battle, and the only way they're able to win is with the help of Trelania of Terrasart. And Prince Zordar is destroyed, Earth is saved, the Comet Empire is defeated, and more adventures will follow years later, considering the English release schedule of Space Battleship Yamato 3. Now, there were problems with Space Battleship Yamato 3 on both sides of the Pacific. The problem, first of all, is that Space Battleship Yamato 3 wasn't all that good, and there are certain reasons for this. The first of which is that, okay, Space Battleship Yamato 2 was also quite successful, and they had actually planned a really big deal about Space Battleship Yamato 3. It was going to be 52 episodes, like they had originally planned. It was going to have lots of interesting subplots. It would have entire episodes that would take place on another Earth space battleship, the Arizona. It would have subplots involving the rise of a cult of peace in a war-torn galaxy. And while they were producing the series, they got a little shock from the executives, who said, yeah, you said 52 episodes, but we kind of switched the digits, so you only have, like, 25. So the first 15 episodes of Space Battleship Yamato 3 were paced like a 52-episode series, but after that, the show starts to get in a real hurry to get itself over with. It's really noticeable. And this also exacerbates one of the other problems of Space Battleship Yamato 3, which is that they've stopped pretending anymore. Basically, the Argo, or Yamato if you're watching the Japanese version, has basically become the One Punch Man of anime space combat. Because, you see, in earlier seasons there was at least the illusion of danger. A lot of the times the Argo was fleeing from Gamelon traps, or escaping from Gamelon armadas. And in Space Battleship Yamato 2, they went up against some formidable opposition. Hell, the Argo was actually crippled in the final episode because it just wasn't strong enough to defeat Zordar's ship. And that goes right out the window in Yamato 3. The Yamato slash Argo is basically invincible against pretty much anything the enemy has to throw at it. Even though there might be some pretend damage, it never really seems to impact the hero's ability to wipe the floor with pretty much anyone and everyone they come across. And the also sudden cut in episodes meant that there isn't nearly as much development of the primary villains, the Bolar Federation, because we had a lot of inside look at the Gamelons in Quest for Iskandar, and the Comet Empire was fairly interesting also because they were nomadic warrior conquerors, you know, almost, they're kind of like space Mongol horde, kind of, going everywhere and making subject peoples out of pretty much anyone they came across. But the Bolars are fairly generic villains because of all of this, which is a real shame because it's a very Cold War kind of story, because Earth is in danger of being destroyed again because of an accident. Basically, a stray shot in the struggle between two much larger space empires, and Earth is a tiny neutral state caught in the middle. So it's a real shame that it never really made the best use of the material they had wanted to put together for the series. Now, on the English side of it, there were a couple of problems. First off, the deal to bring over Space Battleship Yamato 1 and 2 was made before Space Battleship Yamato 3 had aired, so a separate deal was made, and Space Battleship Yamato 3 was brought over as Star Blazers The Bolar Wars years after the airing of Quest for Iskandar and Comet Empire, So a lot of the original voice actors for those series, you know, like Chris Latta, weren't available anymore. So they had to scrimp and scrounge for an entirely new set of voice actors, and they even brought on some of the old Speed Racer hands for Bowler Wars. And other things include the fact that there were actually two movies in between Comet Empire and Bowler Wars that were in continuity with the Space Battleship Yamato series. So they introduced new characters to replace the ones that had died at the end of Comet Empire. But these characters were introduced and established in these movies that we never got. So that's also another problem. So as a result, this series never really got the same sort of play as Quest for Iskandar and Comet Empire, and another thing that accounted for its diminished popularity is that was released in far fewer TV markets. So there really is some good things to talk about with the Bowler Wars, but not nearly as much as, say, Comet Empire. However, there are two major reasons that the production of Bowler Wars turned out to be such a... Well, it turned out to be so ramshackle. You know, with fewer voice actors to do more roles, and also with untranslated Japanese subtitles in a lot of scenes. The reason for this all comes down to money, and there are two money reasons. The first is that in 1980 or thereabouts, the regulations concerning advertising content in children's television shows was substantially relaxed. Let's put it that way. So between 1980 and 1984, which is when Comet Empire aired and when Bowler Wars was aired, this was the beginning of the explosion of the toy commercial cartoons, and a lot of the important television production companies wanted a piece of the Hasbro pie. So this is when He-Man started, this is when G.I. Joe started, this is when Transformers started. The second thing is that Star Blazers was an older property, and even people who were considering localizing other anime series were looking for things a bit more recent, and some of these people had very ambitious projects in mind. The year after Bowler Wars aired, Carl Masek showed up with Robotech, which ended up probably being the most popular anime release for American television, basically until Dragon Ball Z showed up. So let's get on with Bowler Wars. Like I said, it's a Cold War story, so here's how it begins. Basically, sometime after the end of Comet Empire, two emergent galactic superpowers have decided to throw out the negotiating table and go to war, the Galman Empire and the Bowler Federation. And in one of their battles, which takes place near the solar system, a planet-killing missile launched by a Galman ship goes off course and hits the sun, destabilizing it completely and causing it to start to heat up. So humanity has to move back into the underground cities they built for the Gamelon War. However, these won't hold out forever, so the Argo, along with other resurrected space battleships, the Bismarck, the Prince of Wales, and the Arizona, are all off to outer space to find a new home for humanity. However, on the way out of the solar system, the Argo helps a ship from the Bowler Federation, which the Galman commander Dagon takes to mean that humanity has declared for the Bowlers. So the Argo has to fight off attacks from the Galman Empire while it tries to search for a new home. And it also runs afoul of the Bowlers when they find a Bowler gulag planet, basically. Yeah, the Bowlers are basically supposed to be the Soviets. In the English dub, they all have Russian accents. So while fending off the wrath of two empires, the crew of the Argo now has to deal with its most dangerous mission yet. Oh yeah, when I say a new crew, it's because there were some replacements required, and on that note, at the end of Comet Empire, in the Japanese version, Yamato's flight captain was killed, but in the English version, Conroy was just knocked unconscious. So when Conroy showed up again in Bolar Wars, it's no big deal to American audiences. However, that change made things better, because in the Japanese version Space Battleship Yamato 3, the Conroy equivalent apparently had an identical cousin or something like that. An identical brother, maybe? One of those two. So, the real pacing problem that comes to the fore is that 15 episodes are spent fending off attacks from the Galman, and 10 have to be resolving everything else. But it turns out that the Galman Empire is commanded by none other than our friend, Leader Deslock. He really gets around. So, Leader Deslock is generally unaware that his guys are fighting the people he said he would never fight again. And he is distracted by other problems, because in the war-torn galaxy, a cult of peace is beginning to emerge and to undermine military operations. But Leader Deslock finds out that his people have been attacking his friends, the Star Force, and he is furious. He invites the Star Force over to Galman, which is apparently the ancestral homeland of the Gamelon people. And he apologizes and sets his scientists on working on stabilizing the Wayward Sun, which, by the way, fails miserably. So, what happens next is basically a rehash of the story of Quest to Iskandar, because they discover some trap planets along the way, along with the wreck of the space battleship Arizona, a story which was cut when they moved from 52 episodes to 25. Thank you very much. But they eventually find the planet that is the origin of this cult of peace, and they were once an advanced civilization that ruled their own vast space empire, but they turned away from the ways of war. So they give the Star Force and the Argo the means to restabilize the sun, and the Galmans actually throw in their lot with the Star Force against the attacks of the Bolar Federation. So the Argo returns home to stabilize the sun. They are waylaid by the supreme leader of the Bolar's Black Hole Fortress. Leader Deslock comes in to save them. The sun is stabilized, the Earth is saved, and Earth is kind of scorched, so I hope they still have the Cosmo DNA. And the reason that this seems kind of sparse is because not much plot advancement really happens over the first 15 episodes of the show. All of the really major events happen at the back end of the series. So there isn't much time to really develop all that much of anything. However, there are some decent spots to this series, such as the fact that even though there were years between the production of Comet Empire and Bolar Wars with entirely different teams and entirely different voice actors, the characterization is still pretty spot on. Leader Deslock isn't quite as sassy as he used to be, but other than that, it's pretty solid, which is surprising. And it also added some nice little dialogue moments through the editing, such as one of the things that series edited for American television did was that they made enemy soldiers robot soldiers, and there's even a mention of robot tanks in Comet Empire. And when General Dagan, after his latest failure, has to report back to his commander, the commander says, "If you fail again, I'm going to roboticize you." Which paints a kind of a grim picture for people who failed the Galman Empire. Another thing is that a funeral normally made for the crew of the Yamato in the original show was instead changed to a funeral for the enemy dead, with this little jab probably at Voltron. even though most of the enemies we fought were robot soldiers, there were still real soldiers among them who were doing their duty to their country, so this funeral is for them as well. So, still, little things like that still managed to shine through. But that was really the end of Star Blazers on American television. As I said, the show played to fewer markets, and it didn't really repeat for very long. So what really was the legacy of Star Blazers? Well, Space Battleship Yamato, on the Japanese side, was a really big success for Yoshinobu Nishizaki, and he never really had another one. Leiji Matsumoto, on the other hand, went off to do some really unique other projects, like Galaxy Express 999 and its associated movies, and Millennia Queen, and Captain Harlock, as well as Interstellar 5555, which was basically an extended music video for Daft Punk. He would also work on other Yamato-related projects, but none really achieved the same notability as the original series. And eventually there was a custody battle between him and Nishizaki's estate over who actually had the creative rights to Space Battleship Yamato, and Matsumoto is the guy who won, setting the stage for the excellent remake of the first Space Battleship Yamato story called Yamato 2199. In the United States, while it wasn't enough to kickstart the North American video market, because VCRs didn't really become big until basically Bolar Wars had finished up. However, people tended to remember it fondly, and the show remained on sale actually for a very, very long time. I think there are still DVDs floating around out there. And there's a reason that when Yamato 2199 was released in the U.S. subtitled only, it was referred to as Star Blazers 2199, and there were other things too. Like, when Toonami used to have a streaming section on its website, one of the first shows they added to it was Star Blazers. And whenever you bring up Star Blazers, once again, there are people who watched it back then who still remember it fondly and talk about it as such right now. And really, I think that's one of the best sort of legacies a show can have. So that's Star Blazers for you. And I'll be seeing you with a new episode where we seek the guidance of the North Star. See you then!